Okay, this is the Quote the Raven podcast. This is podcast number... That's a good question. I think this is podcast number 12, although I've lost count. And so do your research elsewhere, as I often say. I still have no introduction music, and I don't really have any type of formal way of introducing these podcasts. But I am super stoked today to have CNBC's own Dr. J., John Najarian on the line, who you might know from any number of CNBC shows. He's always on Halftime Report. He's always on Fast Money. You might know him from his previous company, which was Option Monster, that he founded with his brother. He's a former open outcry trader in Chicago. He has a brand new company called Investitute that's helping educate people that are getting their first foray into stock trading and options trading. He appeared this summer with me in Las Vegas, which was the first time that we got to meet each other. And I got to meet a different John Najarian than I saw on CNBC, and I was very impressed. So what's going on, Doc? How are you?
Hey, Chris. Great to be with you, man. I love all your posts on Quote the Raven. And so it was my pleasure to meet you. So I enjoyed it very much. And I'm really looking forward to the podcast. I think I listened to two of the previous podcasts, and I think you're doing a great job. So hats off to you.
Thanks. You know, you said that to me in Vegas when I first met you, but I thought maybe it was the beer. So, you know, I guess if you're of sound and sober mind now and you're offering me these compliments, I will I'll gratefully accept. Nope. Anyways.
I think you have lots of great insights, and certainly the crowd in Vegas was eating up what you were saying. And I think that the more of us that can do that, go out and talk to folks about what we really do with real money on the line, the better it is for people to understand how real traders trade.
Yeah, we really had a good time in Vegas, and I was specifically impressed by, and I mentioned this on another podcast, but I was, you know, I've met some people on the air from financial media before, and I won't go into which networks or which people, but I have to say I was unimpressed with a couple of people that I met off the air. I think there's plenty of people in the financial media that have this, you know, genuine-like personality when they're on the air, and then they get off the air, and they're either socially completely different, or they're vain, and they're, you know, they kind of think who they are. And the one thing that I really liked about you, John, was, I mean, the first time I met you was at this mixer. We were having a mixer before the... it wasn't a mixer, it was a cocktail hour before the day of the presentations. And we walked up, Maj and I walked up, and there you were, and, you know, beer in hand and skull rings on your finger and, you know, bandana on your head. You know, it was like the badass, you know, beer chugging, motorcycle ring wearing, you know, John Najarian that doesn't make appearances on CNBC often.
Not often enough. If they'd let me, Chris, I would do it.
What do we have to do to get that?
They kind of want it bottled up, I think. They're good folks at CNBC, and I get it. You know, they want it to look professional, and I want to look professional when I'm on there. But when I'm not on CNBC, I'd rather be just what I am and, you know, just like what you were. We were all just... enjoying Vegas, even though, of course, there had just been that tragedy. I mean, literally, when you and I got there, there had just been that tragedy out in Vegas. But nonetheless, it was great to get together with traders. And I remember, it was Nate and a couple other guys came up with that Vegas Strong t-shirt that we were all wearing out there, too. They literally made them up, you know, from Sunday night until we started the thing that next weekend. So that was all pretty cool.
Well, I have to say, you know, sometimes at these events, when they have a personality from television or somebody who's well known, you know, a lot of times they show up and they phone it in and they leave. And You know, I have to say, before I even knew you, when I showed up at this event, you had your Vegas Strong t-shirt on. You had, I think it was a Centerpoint Securities hat on, somebody that was there representing their brand, but you were proudly wearing their hat as well. And you had a group of people around you, and it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't weird at all. It was just like a bunch of people hanging out at the bar. And I was like, holy shit, like, here's a regular guy. You know, here's a regular guy when he's off television. So I was, what did you make of the event? What did you think?
I thought it was great. I thought that was probably one of the most serious crowds of real traders that I'd ever been lucky enough to be out mixing with and talking to and with. It was, you know, because, gosh, so often, and it's perfectly fine, of course. I'm sure you've done it a ton. You show up at an event and there are newbies there as well as, you know, really veteran traders. And it's kind of tough to craft your speech depending on, you know, how far to the beginning side of trading some of those folks are. Not that, you know, I'm not putting them down. I'm just saying, you know, when you've got advanced traders that are shorting things in the market, that's a whole different kind of trader than people who have only ever been long and really only traded stock. I think most of the folks at that Traders for a Cause, and that was one of the reasons I went too, of course, folks, was that Traders for a Cause, they charged a decent ticket for everybody to get in, but the money went to charity. I mean, nobody was taking a salary. Nobody was getting paid. Everybody was basically just participating, and then they gave money to breast cancer research. They gave money in my brother's name for ALS research and so forth. So I was very impressed by the guys that set the meeting up, as well as all the 150, 170 folks that attended.
It really is a cool event. And I have to say, over the course of the last 3 years that I've been going to it, it's come a long way. And, you know, the speakers have always been interesting, and those talks that they, the way that they kind of converted into the talks this year, but there had been something similar years prior. They were always interesting to sit through. I always learned a little bit. And not only that, but the people were real, you know, they were genuine. They were funny. You know, when Sang Lucci would get up there, or, you know, when the day trade would get up there, or any of these guys, you know, they get up there and they let it rip. I mean, they know that they're talking about investing, but they also, you know, guys go up there in jeans and a t-shirt, and it's more about what they have to say than it is about, you know, putting on a front that they're, you know, some great, fantastic trader. And, you know, so guys would routinely go up there and talk about, you know, these huge losses that they took and lessons that they learned. And it's a great event like that. But I just thought that you showed a lot of class, not only in your presentation, which was obviously fantastic. I'm not kissing your ass either. You know, I'm not an ass kisser.
I do know that.
I don't kiss people's ass if I'm not actually impressed. But I thought you showed a lot of class in not only your presentation, but for going for the cause and participating and being there. And not, you know, I was wholly impressed. So, and Nate and Zach have done a really, really good job of kind of, you know, with the help of people like yourself who have name recognition, of, you know, taking that event from something that, you know, may not have brought as many people and turning it into something that annually now is growing. And so I think on behalf of them, they wouldn't mind if I thanked you for that.
Oh, well, again, no need to thank me. I had a riot. I'm going to try to get my brother out there to this one. And hopefully, Chris will be announcing you and I that they'll have a Traders for a Cause in New York, maybe a one-day one they're looking at in May or June in New York at the NASDAQ, hopefully. So we'll see. I know that's something that they're exploring right now, and it would be an opportunity for those that might not have as much time to get all the way. You and I know you're giving up basically 2 or 3 days to get
sure.
to and get home from Vegas, even though Vegas is a riot. So I think having one on the East Coast would be very cool.
New York can be a riot too. You get that crowd anywhere, and we're going to have a good time.
True. And virtually everybody, it was mainly an East Coast crowd as it was. I mean, Sang Lucy, Wall Street Jesus, Nate and Zach. I mean, most of the folks are from either Boston, New York, Philly, like yourself, or, parts of the East Coast. An awful lot of it was East Coast.
Where do you live? Do you live in Chicago or New York, or do you split your time?
Yep. I split my time. I live in Chicago and go back and forth to New York. So most of the time, 1 or 2 days a week, I'm in Chicago, and the weekends, of course, and the rest I'm in New York for Fast Money on one of those shows, like you said, halftime or the other.
So you're traveling quite a bit.
Yeah, I've got, I think I always brag that only George Clooney in Up in the Air has more miles than me on American. but that's not really a badge of honor so much anymore.
Right. What about your brothers? You have the same routine? Is he on CNBC as much as you are? I feel like I'm seeing less of him than I used to.
I think he tries to only be on 2 days a week. And he's coming in from Minnesota. So he moved from Connecticut, just outside of the New York metro area, up to Minnesota. And he loves it up there. Absolutely loves it up in Minnesota. So he went to school there. A lot of his friends are still there. A lot of their wealth management clients are there. So that's the area of the world that you can't hardly pull them out of there, except just to go surfing once a year.
Did you grow up in Chicago?
No, we all grew up out in three younger brothers, and we all grew up in San Francisco. And then moved to Minnesota when we were in our teens.
Okay, just walk me through how you wound up being born in San Francisco and how you wound up on the floor of the CME. And
sure, as quickly and non-boringly as possible.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Because it is an entertainment device, right, these podcasts.
Yeah, we try to keep it real, too, you know?
Sure. Go ahead. I went to school and went to college, came out of college. I was an undrafted free agent, signed with the Bears, so that's what brought me here to Chicago.
Okay.
And then when I got cut, my agent was a trader. He gave me an opportunity to come down on the trading floor. For that, I'm forever grateful. And I never left. I stayed. That was 1981. And I've been here now 37 years. This will be my 38th year after I get to September of this year. So long time, but I love it. And Chicago's a great city. After San Francisco, you can't go just anywhere because you're kind of spoiled. But Chicago is pretty cool.
So what position did you play? Forgive me for not researching anything in advance, but
no,
that's the way I
no.
do it.
No problem. I played linebacker in college and pro, and so I got to play linebacker when Singletary held out on his contract, so I got to play linebacker for a bit then. Wow. But no starring roles for me. I'm not trying to take any of the glitter from those folks that deserve it. But I certainly had a good time, Chris, trying out for the Bears, playing 4 games with them. And, it wasn't fun getting cut, but I knew they made the right decision because I think most of us would agree Mike Singletary was pretty special.
Your brother was a linebacker as well, right?
Yeah, Pete, all of my brothers were linebackers. Like I say, I had 3 of them. One of them died of ALS, but it was sort of, I guess we were right. We were in between as far as, not quite as big as the linemen and too big to be defensive backs.
Right.
We were all between 6'2 and 6'4 and about 230 pounds. So that's pretty much prototype for a linebacker.
Yeah. Or tight end nowadays, right?
Yeah. Although they do love those big tight ends, 6'5, 6'6. But nonetheless, you're right. Linebacker or tight end, they tend to be built about the same.
So you know, when you said earlier that Pete had made were able to make a donation on behalf of Pete for ALS, that's obviously a cause that's near and dear to you then.
Yeah, absolutely. I think 2 of the last 3 years I chaired the ALS MDA Muscular Dystrophy Association group in New York, and we raised each year a lot of money for them, which is special that people are giving, just like, you know, the Traders for a Cause people were very generous. And it's great when people can give back like that, because just like you said, when you meet somebody that actually does give back rather than just taking, it's nice. And there are a lot of people in finance and trading that are like that. So as many people that you and I would agree are sort of pricks, they're in the minority. There's an awful lot of a majority of us, I'll say, are good guys, good gals that don't mind even showing somebody else how to do something if they don't know how.
Right.
And, you know, that was, again, one of the things I really liked, Chris, about that Traders for a Cause event.
And you told me as much there. You know, you said something very similar there. You said, you know, this is an industry that doesn't lack its fair share of assholes, I think was your exact terminology that you used. And you said it was nice to see, you know, a group of, you know, guys who are proficient and guys of, you know, varying skill levels, but guys that mostly understood what they were doing, but all genuinely just nice people that you could hang out and have a beer with, which was kind of cool.
Yep. I agree. All of that's true. So all the more reason, folks, it's not just a plug for Traders for a Cause, but when you see us tweet it, it'll probably be in October again this year out in Vegas. And I think it might be in late May or early June in New York. So make sure if you're somebody who wants to meet a bunch of like-minded professional traders, that's a great place to go, and it benefits a lot of people who need the help.
So, see, so you and your brother obviously both been extremely successful. And, you know, I just wanted to inform people that are listening, and myself included, you know, where did you guys, you know, without being too intrusive, where did you guys find a majority of your success? I mean, you've been able to kind of step back and do all this charity work, and obviously you've made a fantastic name for yourself on, you know, being on CNBC, but everybody kind of in the financial community knows who you are. You know, I know that you started your own business after you left being a floor trader, I believe, and that recently you sold one of your first businesses, which was Option Monster, right? Did you sell Option Monster?
No, we when we sold Trade Monster to E-Trade.
Oh, that's what it was.
We
okay.
only sold the trading platform and all the customers. I mean, customers, you know, it's as they say, Lincoln freed the slaves. So it's not that any of us own customers, but we gathered about 160,000 active traders. And so we sold the software and the trading platform to E-Trade. Most of the customers migrated over with it because they were used to it. And they're now E-Trade customers. Pete and I are not in the brokerage business okay. any longer. And instead, we held on to the money management business and the education and subscription businesses. So those are what we still own now. And that's investitute.com.
So what was the story like when you started being a floor trader? I mean, was it one of these situations? Now, I've seen you and your brother in that floor trading documentary, which I love watching. I watch it all the time. And one of the traders says, you know, the first day I rolled in there, the only thing I could think about was everybody had more on their wrist than I had in my account. And, you know, I know having played professional football, obviously, you know, what was it like when you first got your start there? You obviously started under somebody, right? You didn't go in and immediately start trading your own account. Is that right?
True. Yep. I had to learn it. It was pretty frustrating because, back then in 1981, it was, more of a secret. People were, holding on to the information and the knowledge. They weren't really sharing it. So, and the, you know, people might be thinking right now, well, how does that work? you know, how is anything sort of a secret? Well, before the internet,
right,
you know, people used to have to go to the library and read on various subjects if you wanted to educate yourself on it. And if it was something as new as options were, they'd only been around. Listed options started in 73, I believe. So they started with just call options. And then even though I started in 81, I believe only about half of the stocks had puts listed on them, because they were kind of wondering why anybody would ever even want puts.
Right.
So then they kind of figured it out, and they obviously puts and calls go together. And the opportunities created by those were immense. And so people that figured it out wanted to kind of hold on to that knowledge. It was really a secret.
Sure.
Because you wanted to make as much money as you could before other people figured it
out. Sure. Yep.
And so that was, it was frustrating, Chris, when we started, when I started, and I was by myself. I didn't have anybody to show me, even though I had my agent that started me in the business. The guys that he was backing at the time were too busy trying to figure it out themselves and trying to make money. So it was a frustrating first few months. It wasn't fun.
So what instruments were you trading? Where did you start? What did you go through?
Yeah,
and where'd you wind up?
I wasn't trading anything. I was only basically being a clerk.
Okay.
Running, you know, trading cards out to guys, trying to figure out what the heck was going on. And like I say, not a lot of fun. But then about 3.5-4 months into it, the light came on and I kind of figured things out. And then it became fun. Then it was something where I could basically say, okay, I could do this for a living. Because once you figured it out, it was something that became very intuitive very quickly. But until you figured it out, it was very frustrating, because trading stocks, that's one thing, but then trading all these derivatives,
right,
and doing spreads with all these derivatives, that's a whole different animal.
And doing spreads using hand signals, using arbitrage, right?
Yep. Trading as fast as you can, because virtually everybody, that's what they're doing. They're trying to trade fast. They're trying to make markets, and they're trying to cut the other guy out, because the more people that are on that ticket, as we call it, on that trade, the more likely it is that we're all racing the stock up or down.
Right.
You want to get on it before everybody else so that you can actually profit.
So as you were starting to learn arbitrage and you were starting to learn the hand signals, what was like the biggest fuck up that you ever made? Because we had Ryan on. I had Ryan on like a couple weeks ago. You know, Ryan Sellers, Open Outcry, and I asked him the same question. You know,
I'd say for me it was I got too long premium. Because when you're long premium, you need the market to move.
Right.
And so I made a bunch of money really fast being long premium. And then whenever the market would give me the opportunity, I'd buy premium. But I probably lost more money faster being long premium than anything else. And it's painful as hell. In other words, if you're betting that the market is going to stay volatile like it is right now, with a VIX of, say, 23 or 24, and all of a sudden it flips and starts going down to 18, 19 area, and then it collapses down to 15, you're going to lose a ton of money.
Right.
And that's just what happened to me. I bled out. Didn't lose all that I made, but I made a bunch really fast after those first few months, and then I bled out. And, you know, there's nothing that'll show you don't know as much as you think you know as losing a couple million bucks really fast.
But that wasn't like a miscommunication, though. That was the trade you wanted to put on, right? And you just picked the wrong trade.
Right. I you know, knock on wood, I don't think I ever lost money on an out trade, on a trade like Chris is saying, folks, a trade where you thought you were buying and you were actually selling.
Right.
I never had that problem.
Or you wanted to buy 100 and you bought 1,000 instead, or, you know.
Right. No problems like that. And probably very few traders do most of us probably, you're on the wrong side of either volatility or market direction when you suffered your biggest losses, not so much just a straight out error. All those do happen, and that would be incredibly frustrating.
You go through the arbitrage training, though, prior to becoming a clerk, right? It's not like they throw you on the floor as a clerk and then teach you the arbitrage after that. I saw a video of them training these guys. There's a whole series of training programs you go through to learn the hand signals first, right?
True. So rarely is somebody going to get that wrong. They're going to be, you know, by the time they're on the trading floor, they're going to know what they're supposed to be doing when somebody says buy them or sold. You're going to know what you're supposed to do to hedge that trade very quickly, or they wouldn't have put you on the floor.
Right.
And for a while, it was really easy, and you could find anybody, you know, a kid out of McDonald's with no training. You could basically work him hard for a week, throw him in the pits, and he could be clerking for you and doing a great job. But then the more competition that sprouts, the tougher it is for you to basically eke out that same amount of money. And a lot of those guys kind of get carved up and thrown out.
And I imagine as option trading evolved and it went from just buying, you know, vanilla calls and nothing else to, you know, putting on different types of spreads and strangles and calendar spreads and straddles and all these different, you know, things that you can do with options. Did it evolve, I guess? Did it become a little bit more complex as you were there?
Yep, it became, and they tried to make it so. And then the customers became better and better too. So by customers, I mean, you know, the broker who's standing next to you in the pit, if he or she is just buying or selling based on the orders that they get, it can be relatively easy to make money. But then when the customers start becoming more and more like you, more and more like a professional trader, where they know what they should be buying and they start bidding on certain spreads, then it becomes much tougher, because obviously when they're trading a spread, they're not just giving away money. They're giving up the bid-ask spread, the difference between the bid and the offer on those calls and puts. But when they're doing a spread, they're giving up less of that. And in fact, it's less directional usually when they're putting on a spread than just a naked option position. So you don't have the opportunity to really make as much money as fast. You have to more or less just trade an awful lot more. So it became a volume game. You had to do, you know, 5,000, 10,000 options a day rather than just, you know, a small number of options each day.
And so was Pete on the floor with you right from the get-go, or did you guys work together? How did it wind up that you both wound up there?
Well, he was playing pro football, and he played for about 6 years. So he's 6 years younger than me.
Okay.
So in probably 87, he graduated college, I'll say. And then he played 6 years of pro football. So he came to the floor in either 92 or 93, I think. And basically, he started clerking for us, and he figured it out really fast, and he was very aggressive and very smart. So he did well right from the start. But, you know, again, he was a clerk at first, which means he wasn't making a ton of money. No
right.
clerk makes a lot of money, no matter who you are. But once they get good at it, clerks are very valuable. And he wasn't a clerk for long. He was probably a clerk for 3 or 4 months, and then he was in there trading and doing a great job.
Well, the fact that you were both ex-NFL linebackers probably helped you out with the physicality aspect of the job, I can imagine. I mean, was it like, did you guys have a reputation when you, because I know it was very physical on the floor, especially, you know, back when all there was open outcry. Did you guys kind of have a reputation as guys that, you know, could hold their own, or did you find that people just didn't give a fuck and kind of would elbow you and shoulder you and knock you out of the way once you were down on the floor? Didn't matter.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, what Pete was surprised by, Chris, and I'm sure you would be too, is that, you know, you're trading down there on the floor. And again, 95% of the people are really, good people,
right,
even though they're your competition, but they're good folks. And then 5% or less, depending on the pit, were, you know, complete the opposite, you know, right, people you couldn't stand and people that were always trying to get under your skin and everything else. So, you know, these same people would more or less give Pete a real hard time as he's trying to break into their pit.
Sure.
And yet here's a guy that's 6'3", 255. So you don't want to give him too much crap because he's not going to take it.
Right.
So he basically, you know, invite people outside to discuss matters from time to time. And rarely would ever anybody even consider going outside with him because, again, that's Pete is a mean dude. He's very smart and very nice, but you don't want to be on his bad side. And so, you know, more than one person, when Pete would confront them and say, okay, you know, sooner or later, you're going to have to leave and I'll be waiting for you outside.
Right.
The guy would be like, hey, man, this is just all for show, right? And Pete would be, no, no, this is not for show. I'm going to see you outside. And we're going to settle this. And the guy would inevitably, you know, apologize and so forth.
Right. You don't have much of an option at that point, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, and he wasn't the only one. As you saw from that movie, Floored, there were an awful lot of both former pro athletes on the trading floor.
Right.
And, you know, people that weren't used to taking guff from anybody. So that was not exactly what you wanted to do if you wanted to have a long career.
And what was the expression? It was like, meet me by the horse or something. Wasn't there a statue up front that everybody met by when they were going to?
There was. And very few people ever went there because the horse, like you say, there's this statue of a horse outside. And that's where you'd say, let's go to the horse. And that meant you were going to fight. And most of the people were all talk and they weren't really going to follow up on it. And Pete was one of those guys that would, and like I say, other guys that were either triathletes or, you know, former hockey players, former baseball players or whatever, weren't really very much into taking crap from a bunch of nerds because half of the trading floor, Chris, is nerds. You know what I mean? Guys that are really fast with numbers in their head, and they tend to be more like nerds.
Yeah, I know. Well, they talk a lot of shit on Twitter nowadays too. And there's no more.
Oh, yeah.
There's no more yapping on the trading floor. They get on their keyboard from 2,000 miles away and will tell you what a piece of shit you are.
Yep.
through the comfort of the internet.
Yep. That's one of the worst things about the internet is all the folks that I'm sure you have to deal with all the time too, telling you about how dumb that last call of yours was. You probably get that less than I do, but I get hate from both sides, bulls and bears.
Yeah, and nobody ever wants to, at least I've found it, and, you know, there's one person in particular who will remain nameless but has been an outspoken critic of mine for a long time, which is fine. I'm not out to please everybody. I'm okay with criticism. You know, I don't really care, to be honest with you, but we happened to be in the vicinity of one another in New York City a couple months ago, and I, through a proxy, said, why don't we get together and we have a drink? You know, maybe we can squash this thing and at least talk about it in person. Of course, it didn't happen, you know, so that's how it goes, I guess. What was
kind of funny how all the talk kind of goes away when it's when you can't hide behind the keyboard.
I guess so, buddy. I guess so. What was, just give me your quick, you know, don't think about it too much, but when you were on the floor, what was one or two of the craziest things that you saw happen on the floor?
I saw a guy crap in a box for money.
How come you never mentioned that on CNBC?
You can imagine why. I'll have to regale that one over at Traders for a Cause this next year. But yeah, somebody made a bet with this kid that he wouldn't. And sure enough, he did. So.
But Is it right on the trading floor?
Right on the trade, right in the pit.
And what, right in the pit. What pit was
you
it?
You can only imagine the smell, Chris.
Was it during the day?
During trading hours, yeah.
What time of the day was it?
And I'm not the only one that would tell you that. There are other people that would. Most people would not want it spread around that that happened, but then people from the trading floor would tell you, "Oh yeah, I know that kid. He did." It was like 10 or 12,000 bucks too. It wasn't you know, I'll bet you $50 you won't. It was like they did things like this. They would, and I think this is how it started, in fact. They would pass around, they had boxes that brokers would stand on, wooden boxes that were very, very strong. And they'd usually have like an anti-skid thing on the top so that the broker wouldn't fall off. Well, so they would pass this around the floor and they'd say, let's play box of bucks or something like that, they'd call it. And everybody would take out a $5 or a $10 bill or whatever they were playing for, put their name on it and drop it into the box. And so when you have a big pit of, you know, 500 guys and virtually all of them have put in, you know, 10 or 20 bucks, whatever it is, whoever wins is going to walk away with several thousand dollars, right? So, you know, they'd always have some hot girl reach into the box and, you know, pull out one of the bills and then look at it and say, Chris Irons. And Chris, yeah. And, you know, and everybody's, you know, drinks are on Chris, and everybody go off with Chris, you know, to the bar or whatever. But this box, somebody made a bet with somebody in the pit that there were always bets going on about, you know, could you drink a gallon of milk in so many minutes?
Right.
Could you eat this much ice cream in so many minutes? Could you eat so many Big Macs and all the rest? And they'd always make those bets, and they'd get tens of thousands of dollars on those bets. And then they'd go upstairs, you know, and it'd be some big kid from, you know, like Notre Dame or Michigan or whatever that would be, you know, 6'5", 270. No, oh yeah, this kid can eat 22 Big Macs. No way, no one can eat 22 Big Macs. Oh yeah, he can. Well, most of these bets were, as you know, basically impossible. Not just because, you know, people are big, but because your stomach's only so big, you cannot hold down, you know, a gallon of milk.
Right, right.
If you drink it in 15 minutes because your body can't process.
And everybody knew that going into it aside from the guy who said he could do it.
Yeah, well, all these other idiots would just figure this is the guy that can. He's 6'5", he's 270, he can do it. So, you know, he'd start chugging away and he'd get half of it down really fast, and then he'd, you know he has so many more minutes and he's chugging it down, and all of a sudden it would just be explosion. The guy would just, you know, hurl everywhere, and it was, you know, it was just craziest thing you ever saw. They didn't do that in the pit, of course, but they would do it upstairs in the members lounge, and, you know, it would be, you know, some poor kid was trying to eat so much ice cream, so many Big Macs, so many donuts or whatever it was. Well, sooner or later, somebody said, you know what? I bet you won't crap in that box. And the kid said, give it to me.
What time of day was it?
Nah, it was probably about within the last hour of trading.
Okay,
so nobody could leave the pit.
Right, because, and things were picking back up again probably, right?
Yep. I mean, you get the noon swoon when everybody just kind of, you know, stops trading, you know, and goes to lunch. And that's not true, of course. People still trade during the noon swoon, but the pits generally empty out unless it's really busy. You'll see a drop of 30-40% in the pit during noon, during the lunch hour, and then picks up towards the end of the day, like you said, Chris. So in the final hour, nobody's leaving the pit unless it's just a day when nothing's moving. On a day like today, when you and I are talking, when the S&P is making a 3% move, I guarantee you everybody was in the pit.
Right.
And like you said about plunge protection or whatever, you know, something happened in that last hour that saved it. I don't know what. Maybe it was plunge protection. But, you know, people are going to stick around just for that, just to see if we go from down 3% to only down, you know, 2% or whatever, because that can be a big winner for you with out of the money calls or
right.
The puts you shorted, whatever it might be. So everybody's in the pit and everybody got a good whiff of that kid that was doing that dastardly deed.
So he shit in a box in the pit, mm-hmm. right in the last hour of trading. And yep. Was he like fined by the, there has to be like regulators or somebody there that, or was it just yep. like there was such a crowd, nobody even noticed, they just kind of let him slide, or what happened?
I think eventually, you know, the word got out about it and the kid got fired, which is sad. But I mean, I believe that's what happened. It wasn't the pit that I traded in. So, you could, you know, people heard about it all across the floor. And just like you said about, you know, I'll meet you at the horse. If people hear that there is going to be a big fight or something, everybody will start, you know, heading out for the big fight. So then the floor officials, the cops, as you would call them, would say, okay, anybody who walks out right now is going to get fined.
Right.
Because it's disruptive to trading. You can't go out and watch these two idiots fight. And by the way, we're going to fine them both if they go out and that kind of stuff.
I'm just waiting for you to say, and that kid grew up to be, you know, Jamie Dimon, you know,
Jamie is a special dude. I've known him for a while, but yeah, I would say that's about as far from Jamie Dimon as anything could be.
Tell me it's somebody famous now. Tell me it's somebody that's really well known.
No. I couldn't even tell you the guy's name.
He just drifted into obscurity. He's the forever living infamy as the kid that shit in the box.
Yeah, true.
Anyways, everybody's got to be known for something, I guess.
Yeah, he was probably not destined for greatness anyway on the trading floor. That's just a wild guess on my part.
So, look, you just mentioned the plunge protection team, so I'm going to don my tinfoil hat here for a second. You know, I just did an entire podcast, the last one I did, about how frustrated I was with the, you know, mainstream media and how, you know, not necessarily, you know, not necessarily just the financial media, but just the mainstream media in general and how they're, you know, covering all of this Stormy Daniels affair that's happening with Donald Trump and it's getting all this press. And, you know, we see a sharp move like today where sentiment seems to be absolutely horrific all day. There seem to be no buyers all day. You know, the futures were just getting rocked. It was one huge, massive volume sell after another. Every time it looked like it was going to rebound, it looked like there was a huge seller in the market. And then all of a sudden, you know, towards the end of the day, it looks like somebody flips a switch and you know, the market's bid back up. The Dow futures are bid back up 300 points in an hour or something. And, you know, I was talking to you just for a second before we got on about the interview that Asher Edelman did last year. I think it was on Fast Money. You weren't on the panel when he gave it. But he seemed pretty convinced that, you know, the plunge protection team is actually, well, first off, we know it's a real thing, right? We know the president's working group on financial markets or whatever they're called is, you know, Ronald Reagan drafted an executive order that's been signed. It's a real thing. Their goal is to maintain investor confidence in the market. It's supposedly made up of, you know, the chair of the SEC, the Fed chair, the head of the Commodity and Futures Trading Association. And you see things like today happen, and you kind of see the way the market has been, even just technically, John. Like, if you look at the technicals over the last 5 or 6 years, anytime the market has kind of fallen under its trend line or fallen under a major moving average, it kind of bucks up. There's never a trend break. And I would love to know your off-air opinion on whether or not, you know, look, Japan does it. China does it. We already know that, you know, the Fed doesn't have any problem manipulating the bond market, which they do. Is it that far of a stretch to think that the Fed is in the equity market or in the S&P futures?
I will say that I don't know who and in the government, if it's the Fed, the Treasury, or whomever, but I will agree with you that I think in all likelihood there is a plunge protection team. And you know, I don't know if that's heresy to say it or not, but it certainly seems, Chris, like it stretches credulity to have some just magic force that just happens to appear, and it's not a coordinated effort from Goldman and Morgan and JP Morgan and so forth. I think it's beyond that. I think it is somebody that probably has trading experience and also knows when would be the best time of day
right.
to execute those kinds of trades. Because, I mean, you know, again, on this particular day, folks, it's the first trading day of the new quarter. Market was down 3% at noon and looking like it would, you know, be lucky to not be down 4% or more.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the big stocks like Amazon were down 5-6%. And, you know, at the bottom, the S&P today was down around 25.55 or something like that. We finished almost 30 points higher than that. And pushed almost back, Chris, to the 200-day moving average.
Right.
So is, you know, if we can reclaim the 200-day again, I'm not saying everybody will breathe a sigh of relief, but they'll be thinking, well, you know, can Trump really have another trade war? Or is he going to rest with one trade war at a time? And if so, and you were able to stop the bleeding, could this have been a tradable bottom today? I know a lot of folks would probably say if we can retake that 200 day that things are not back to normal, but are certainly not as dark as they were at noon today on the 2nd of April.
And that's the thing with these technicals, right? They're like self-fulfilling prophecies. So ostensibly, if there was a plunge protection team, right, and they were in the futures market and they were buying S&P futures, which is, you know, what the rumor is, at least my tinfoil hat conspiracy rumor that I've heard, that's what you would want to do, because when you get above the 200-day moving average in the S&P, what that does is not only does it, you know, obviously function as something that props the market up itself, but it changes sentiment. You know, like you just said, you know, if you can reclaim the 200-day moving average, it's a milestone for people to talk about, to say, oh, well, maybe things aren't as bad as they look, and that can actually induce, you know, all these people that trade on charts and trade on, you know, technicals to kind of breathe a sigh of relief and then get some actual capital to come back into the market. So I think it makes sense what you're saying. If they are,
It wouldn't shock me. Other things in the market might shock me, but that wouldn't shock me, that somebody would be able to convince somebody else that this is something that would be good for the market, to have somebody out there that would be watching the market's back, if you will.
So let's just zoom out to a, you know, from an intraday chart to like a decade long chart, right? And if that's the case, if the Fed's really in the market or the government's really in the market, how long can they continue to do that? I mean, are you one of these believers that in 30 years, 40 years, the Dow could be at 500,000, or are you, you know, are you in the camp that eventually, you know, we'll have hyperinflation or we'll have a sovereign debt crisis, or are you somewhere in between? Where do you see things on a very long view?
What I didn't see, I'll be the first to admit, Chris, is that I did not see social media coming apart like this, because I didn't see Cambridge Analytica being a story that would break. I don't think any of us did. But the fact that it did and has caused people to reconsider the growth rate for all the social media stocks, not just Facebook, you know, all the terms that we sign up for when we use Google Chrome or Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat or whatever, are probably making some people uncomfortable. Some people will delete it. Not everybody, of course, not even a majority. But does it mean that if they have to cut back so significantly from what was their business model, declared or otherwise, could these projections and could these valuations be too high? And the answer is yes, in my mind. And I didn't see it coming. I didn't see that as the catalyst. I saw more like a debt, not a crisis, but the fact that debt at 0% or, you know, low interest rates is a lot easier to finance than debt at higher interest rates. So I'm, you know, I get a Nobel Prize for saying that, but I think that that was what I thought would be the catalyst to more or less let the market come, maybe not undone, but cause the next correction. So I missed that because this was a full, you know, 10% or right here, well, and a little more.
Well, I mean, to that point, you know, rates are still on the rise. And so the screws are tightening on debt, not just for corporations, but on personal balance sheets, too, on household balance sheets and on government balance sheets. So, you know, I think probably that thesis is still in the midst of playing out, you know, and Facebook has very considerable cash flow as well, as opposed to a company like a Tesla, you know, which has negative operating leverage and no cash flow.
Right.
So here I'm going to ask you two questions. One is, I guess first is you tell me whether or not you're long or short Facebook or Tesla, number one. Number two, you know, do you think that a company like Tesla can survive much longer if this market starts to get a little bit more skeptical? And by that, I mean a company that, you know, isn't producing anything, has no cash flow, constantly needs to raise significant amounts of capital. Versus like a Facebook, you know, that now on an earnings basis is a little bit cheaper, but they do generate a lot of cash. And there's talk of them, namely by me, having possibly a, you know, a MySpace moment. So why don't you give me your thoughts on all that?
Sure. I'll hit Facebook first. I had no position on the drop. Everybody that was giving me shit was constantly giving me that because I was just tweeting out all the bad stuff about Facebook because I think, quite frankly, Zuckerberg lied to everybody. I think, you know, there are plenty of interviews that have him basically saying he wasn't going to do what he did, and that is sell people's data. Right. I agree with Howard Stern that anybody who was swayed in the election by something they read on Facebook is an idiot. But, you know, nonetheless, there might be a majority of Americans that are idiots. I don't know. you know, I wouldn't want to bet against it. As right. as P.T. Barnum would say, sucker born every minute, right. two to take them. Maybe there are that many idiots. I prefer not to believe that, but maybe there are. And maybe they were enough of them were swayed in the election by something they read on Facebook. God forbid, but maybe. But what I think that the real dastardly part is that they, you know, have that those terms of service. But I was not somebody who was short it. I have been long it at times, but for the last 3 weeks, I can say unequivocally, I never was short the stock. I did buy it on March 26th at 150 and about 50 cents. Which was not the bottom. It went through 150, went to 149 or so. But I bought it because it was. I just thought it was overdone. I was looking at the volume, Chris. And to me, other than options, volume tells me everything I need to know. So that was a puke that day, I thought. Right. I thought we went down hard enough that day with like 130 million shares changing hands that was enough, that was the puke. So that's why I bought it. And then I immediately, as it rallied, which I was lucky in my timing on that, but as it rallied, I sold the 160s, I sold the 162.50s, I sold the 165s against it. Virtually all of those are worthless now with the stock, let's say, at 154 or 155. And I'll probably stay long Facebook for a while and just keep hammering high volatility calls into it. So that's my position in Facebook. And in full disclosure, I said that last week when I did it to anybody who was following CBOE TV or whatever, because I was on vacation, so I wasn't on CNBC.
Okay. And it's a good time. It's a great time to sell covered calls right now.
Yep.
You know, with the VIX at 25, 26. And, you know,
that's when you want to do it.
Unlike
that's
Tesla,
when balls are high.
Facebook is a company that regardless, you know, whether earnings estimates come down or not and the multiple expands a little bit or not, at least it has a very steady cash flow stream to kind of fall back on. You know, I think it's generating something like $15 billion or $10 billion in free cash a year versus our other competitor, Tesla. When you talk to me about Tesla for a minute.
All right. Tesla, I think they may have finally called Musk's bluff in Tesla, because we all know that whenever there has been a question about why they missed on deliveries of whatever vehicle it was, whether it's the Model 3, the S, the X, whatever it was, Musk always had some magic that he could, you know, pull out of his hat and wave it around and people, you know, be mystified by it and just go chasing back in. This doesn't seem to be quite the same right now. Now, on the other hand, turning over, you know, since I said, you know, to me, volume is truth. We have jacked up volumes like crazy in here. It's gone from 4 and 5 million share average turnover as it's made this big drop just since last Monday. Last Monday, folks, the 26th, it was $307 or $8 a share. Today, it hit $244. Now, that's something that'll leave a mark in my book. But I don't know if we've seen the washout in there. I think overall that I'm going to trade Tesla at some point again, but I have no position right now, Chris. How about you? Are you still looking for more downside?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, to me, it's and in full disclosure, I have a very, 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 very small vanilla put position that's long dated that is in an account that I don't look at. So I'm a long term bear, and I've traded around it also too. But you know, to me, when I look at something like Tesla, and there's no, you know, there's no equity in the on the balance sheet. There's, you know, $20 a share in equity on the balance sheet. And there is a cash flow stream that is just getting worse and operating leverage that is, you know, moving in the wrong direction. The more they produce, the more money they lose. And it's a company that's reliant on, you know, going to the market one way or another, whether it's the debt market or the equity market to fund operations. I think you're 100% right when you say it's a question of when the market is going to call this guy's bluff. Because right now you have a $50 billion valuation that's based on nothing. I mean, it's just based on the Elon Musk brand. So to me, I mean, I see the downside from a, you know, I guess just looking from an equity and cash flow perspective as much, much, much lower, you know, $20, $30, $50. I think maybe at that point that's when you start to think about somebody coming in and just buying them for the brand once it becomes maybe a $2 billion or $3 billion brand. But I mean, between what they did with rolling up SolarCity, which is a money gushing entity that happened to be owned by a related party with a ton of debt that was really up Schitt's Creek by itself, and not being able to, in a viable fashion, manufacture and produce vehicles profitably, I think they have a huge fucking problem. I mean,
yeah.
Unless there's something I'm missing, John, you know?
No, I know what you mean. I mean, Musk, like I said, he's been a showman. We all know that that can work until it doesn't.
Right.
He would probably be better off just concentrating on SpaceX, because that's something that he seems to really have a significant edge even over Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, you right. know, that Jeff runs as his space program. But as far as the competition, you know, anybody that doesn't see what you're saying, Chris, about competition just ramping significantly against Tesla is kidding themselves.
Right.
They're a great company they make a great vehicle. They might not be a great company because of the debt and because of what they've got to do to get to the production that'll justify their market cap.
What do you make of all the executive turnover that's happened there too? I mean, I went over on my podcast maybe a week ago and read about 35 or 40, if not C-suite executives, top VPs, division managers, and, you know, maybe the next tier down executives that including, you know, some the chief accounting officer. They've gone through a couple CFOs that have just turned. They've turned over an incredible amount of employees in a very short amount of time. What does that say to you?
Well, I think the same thing it says to you, that, you know, I'm sure Musk is a genius. I'm sure he is in love with his own image. And I don't just mean the way he looks. I mean, you know, the image of him being a genius. Right. I'm sure he's in love with that. That doesn't mean that he can't continue. But, you know, again, the more people put pen to paper or pencil to paper like you have and said he's got to deliver this to justify that, the tougher it is for him. And, you know, his own worst enemy is, you know, the idea that the stock has gotten so far ahead of itself, even perhaps at 250, it's still way ahead of itself. So, you know, if you've sat in his cars, you're probably impressed. There's lots of things to love about the product, but that doesn't mean that I'm in love with the stock, because, and that's why I don't own a single share. I haven't seen any unusual activity that would justify me being in that stock. So I have no positions in Tesla right now. None.
All right. So how are you doing on time, by the way? Okay. You have another 20 minutes, half hour, or talk to me honestly.
I have quite that much, but I'd have at least another 10.
Okay, perfect. So then I'll cut right to the chase. So there's two more things I wanted to touch on. The first was NetElement, which is a company that you just have been appointed to the board of.
Sure.
I wanted to, first off, just get a little bit about the company, have you give me a rundown of, I don't know anything about them at all, so you can give me the 5-minute elevator pitch on what they do and how they found you and how you wound up on the board. And then in all fairness too, I got a couple of questions from some critics of the company that, you know, were asking about some of the people that had participated in some financings for the company and some promotional services, I guess, that the company uses to get their name out there. So in fairness, I told them I would bring that up and
sure.
Just see if you would talk about
it's
it.
That's all cool. They contacted me and asked me if I would consider coming on the board. And I looked at what NetElement does, and I consider them, and I bet you do too, to be in the payments space. Even though right now in the United States, they can't do payments in the U.S. yet.
Okay.
They've applied for and hopefully very soon will be able to, but they can do it in a number of venues outside of the United States. So I believe they can take in the neighborhood of 100 or 120 different payment methods for transactions. And they include, of course, cryptocurrencies.
Okay.
But they also include card, you know, credit card processing, payments in a variety of other currencies, regular currencies, not just crypto.
Okay.
But all over the globe. They hope to be within this month of April, they hope to be approved to be able to do that in the United States. That is to be able to take payments and basically put a button on your site, Chris, that says you want to subscribe to Quote the Raven and pay in crypto or any one of these other currencies. We can do that right now.
So they're kind of like a Square, but they'll also the big selling point is that they will be a proxy for accepting a broad range of cryptocurrencies.
Yes, sir. Cryptos, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, as well as regular other currencies. And what their model is that they make the spread on those cryptos or other currencies as a point of sale platform. Or as a button on your website, Chris, they would get paid making that spread in, let's say, Bitcoin or Litecoin or whatever between. So you have a, let's say, $1,000 product that somebody's buying on your platform, they could buy it using a crypto, but Chris doesn't want crypto. Chris only wants to be paid in US dollars.
Okay.
They flip the dollars to your account and they take the spread on the crypto, the bid-ask spread on the crypto, which, as you know, is kind of lucrative.
Yeah.
And so whether it's mobile, web, or whether it's point of sale, like in a gas station where you drag your credit card, you know, inside when you're buying chips or whatever, that's what they do. That's what NetElement does.
Yeah, and actually, in all fairness, you had been talking about when we were in Vegas probably 8 months ago or 10 months ago or whatever it was, and we were at that Mexican place. That's all you were talking about was crypto, and I'm sure that you hadn't considered going on the board of this company yet. I know that was something that you were really like very highly engrossed in. You know, the question that I got was in regard to about them paying, I guess, $20,000 a month here for this brand awareness distribution and corporate communications. You know, you have critics of the company that say that it's a promotion. What would you say to those critics?
I would say that, you know, they're looking to get into a highly competitive space. You mentioned Square, which is, of course, more or less the 800-pound gorilla of the alternative payments, I'll call it.
Okay.
Because you've got I consider PayPal way too big. Not in a bad way. I just mean that PayPal to me is an awful lot like Visa, MasterCard, and those guys. They
right.
have so many millions of users that and millions of customers, you know, that are retailers and so forth, that I don't consider PayPal a competitor for these guys. I think they're one of the established giants in the industry, as is Square. But I think these guys are fighting for what's, you know, for basically this more or less new space that
niche,
PayPal
right.
doesn't cover and these other guys don't cover. And that is putting a button on your site and letting you say, we take crypto. I think that's a big deal.
And Square or PayPal, to the best of your understanding, are they developing that? You know, is it something that they're looking into? Because
I don't know that the moat is that big that would stop somebody from getting in there and doing that. But to my knowledge, none of those big guys are doing that yet. So I think that's why NetElement would have an edge. There's another company I've seen called Digits. I've interviewed them, but I have no business relationship with them.
Okay.
And by the way, as you know, Chris, I was delighted to see NetElement stop jump when I joined the board. And I imagine a lot of it was just a short squeeze.
Sure.
But I'm in full disclosure, I can't sell a share. I do own a bunch of shares now, by virtue of both buying in the open market, and by being on the board and being given director's shares, but I can't sell any of them. Or it's not like it's illegal, but it's registered stock.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure, yep.
So I'm like anybody else on an insider. I can't sell unless I disclose that I've sold, and that's not why they put me on the board. They didn't put me on the board to say, oh, John got a bunch of stock at $2 and now he's flipping
right.
out of it at 10. I'd be the biggest you-know-what out
right.
there. So I've not sold a single share,
well,
not one single share.
It's interesting, in full disclosure to you, I had no idea what this company was. I knew nothing about it before we started this interview, before you just told me. As you're telling me that it's a payment processor that accepts crypto, objectively, what I'll inform my listeners, and I'll tell you what you already know, was this is all you were talking about in Vegas was crypto and how you wanted to get yourself into the crypto space more. And, you know, it was something I was going to bring up if we had more time to, given the fact that a lot of the cryptocurrencies
we'll have
crashed.
On another one.
Definitely. But in fairness, in fairness to you, This isn't like something that just came out of the blue that you said, oh, well, now I'm going to, you know, now I'm going to get interested in crypto. And it wasn't something you had considered in the past. So if you want, before we take off, why don't you just give me 2 minutes on Investitute and let the listeners know what it is that you guys do now and how you educate people and tell them a little bit about your service.
Sure. Well, Investitute, folks, is just as the name implies, part investment and part institute. We try to teach people about trading. We have dozens of courses on that site that you can sign up for, do distance learning, which means, of course, that at your own pace, at whatever time of day or night, you have access to PowerPoints, and you can just flip through them at your pace. Most of them are narrated by either me or my brother Pete or by Ron Ioneary, one of the three of us. I believe I did most of them, but we basically just tell people how to, you know, from the basics of here's a put, here's a call, to here's technical analysis, to cryptocurrencies, even the basics of crypto. And then we also have subscription products on there that probably anything I'm talking about on Fast Money, the Halftime Report or the 5 o'clock show, is something that we've seen unusual volume building in that stock, option, or future. And that's why we're talking about it. And we post those in a chat room throughout the day where people can subscribe, see what we're trading, ask us questions, as well as going back and forth with each other, because sort of like that we just started the show with Traders for a Cause. When you're going back and forth with people who have skin in the game, not just Pete or me or Ron or Mike Yamamoto, who more or less is the curator of that blog, but all of the folks in the blog can be going back and forth with each other. They can be saying, I really like the market here at, you know, to play for a bounce. I think plunge protection's coming in or whatever. And other people on the blog can respectfully, because that's one thing we do police, is that it's not just open to anybody. People that are paying money to be in there are in there, but still they have to be respectful of the other opinions that are in there. And they can say, I disagree. I think we're going to, you know, see another downturn and here's why and blah, blah, blah. That's great. That's welcome. And that's what our products are all about, really, is either education or showing people what our computers are talking about to us in that language of algorithmic trading, where things that I can't see with my eyes are showing up on the blog because the computer can see it faster than I can.
Awesome. That sounds, and we'll link to that also in the podcast description when I put it up, which should be later on tonight. But you know, look, John, I've worked really hard over the last couple of years, and I've done okay in building a little bit of a following and some people that are interested in. But there's been some people that who are well known people who along the way have been kind enough. Not only to help me out with things like advice and with, you know, kind of mentorships and things like that, but there's also been people that have taken, you know, somewhat of a chance or somewhat of a risk in helping me along the way or lending their name to something that I'm working on. And you know, certainly in between me and you, you have a lot more to lose than I do out in the public discourse. And I just wanted to thank you for coming on and for speaking to me. I mean, I know I consider you a buddy. We had a great time in Vegas. But at the end of the day, you know, there was no prep for this interview and you weren't really sure what the hell I was going to say. And I kind of like it that way, you know. And so I just want to thank you.
Job,
thank
Chris.
You seriously for coming on and taking the time and speaking to me. It's really
thank
appreciated.
You. Thank you, Chris.
And it was an awesome
I applaud your success. I wish you a lot more of it. And I look forward to coming on with you again. So thanks for having me on. And folks, thanks for listening.
All right, John. Thanks again, buddy. We'll talk soon.
All right, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.